You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. Right now, I'm breathing clean, smoke-free air for the first time in almost a month.
We begin tonight with the state of emergency in California as historic heat fuels dangerous wildfires.
Where I am in Eugene has one of the worst air qualities in the world right now.
As of this broadcast, 87 massive wildfires are burning their way through the West. 35 people have died. Over 5 million acres have burned. And California, Oregon, and Washington have had some of the worst air in the world. So why is this happening now? Poor forest management, both by federal and state governments, is partially to blame, as is increased development in fire-prone areas. But scientists say one of the biggest culprits is climate change.
This is a climate dam emergency.
California Governor Gavin Newsom was clearly shaken after surveying the fire damage.
This is real. And it's happening in unprecedented ways, year in, year out. And that's exactly what the scientists have been predicting for a half a century. It is here now. California, folks, is America fast forward.
As our planet gets hotter, its weather is getting more volatile. And we're not the only people getting hit hard.
At least 60 people have been killed and more than 100 injured in the worst wildfires to hit Greece in more than a decade.
Climate change is one of the greatest challenges of our lifetimes, and we should treat it that way. This week, we start an ongoing series about our climate future. We'll talk about what we're up against, how much change we should expect, and what we can do about it. We start by looking at climate change as a human rights issue. The people who will suffer the worst consequences are the most vulnerable among us, and we're already seeing this. Producer Teresa Katsourilis takes it from here.
Here in California, where wildfires have burned to the edges of farm country, agricultural workers are still going to work, risking heat and smoke to pick grapes and harvest strawberries. This is an essential workforce. It's mostly Latinx, and it's spent decades fighting for better labor protections. Activists are now raising concerns that 2020's wildfires, in the midst of a pandemic, are triggering unsafe work conditions. It's 11 p.m. on a Monday night, and Zeke Guzman is driving through the back roads of Sonoma. The county's COVID-19 infection rate landed it on the state's watch list. So we're both wearing N95 masks, trying our best to somehow keep our distance in the car. When we're outside of Healdsburg, Zeke waves a hand at the vineyards out the window.
Zinfandels, Cabernets, Merlots, Petit Syrahs. And there's fire still going on over there, see?
Zeke points to this shock orange glow between two black hills. It's part of the LNU Lightning Complex fire, which has killed five people and burned over 550 square miles in the region so far. We're right outside the mandatory evacuation zone.
I don't think I've ever seen a fire this close before.
Oh my gosh, this is nothing.
Yeah. Zeke's out tonight in his role as president of Latinos Unidos. He points to a floodlight in a nearby vineyard. There's harvesting going on, he says.
You see right there?
Oh, wow.
Right here?
We pull up alongside the rows of grapes. Have you finished up for the night? He asks a farm worker next to a massive haul of grapes. Her face is covered with a bandana. Do you have masks and everything you need? Yes, yes, she assures him, everything's fine. And this is why Zeke and other labor advocates are driving along the edge of a wildfire's mandatory evacuation zone in the middle of the night. They're trying to check in with workers directly and witness any labor violations in the fields firsthand. This thick, yellow haze of wildfire smoke has settled over parts of California, and scientists say it can get toxic. When it gets dense, you need certain kinds of gear to filter it out, like an N95 mask. But farm workers across California say they aren't getting the masks or basic safety gear they need. Zeke used to be a farm worker himself. When he was a kid, his dad marched with Cesar Chavez and used to spray pesticides on prune trees without protective gear.
All he did was put a cap and sunglasses on.
Zeke says he thinks the job's actually gotten harder since then.
It's a very hard time to be a farm worker in this moment.
David Horneig is senior safety engineer with California's Division of Occupational Safety and Health, also known as Cal OSHA. He's the agency's heat and agricultural program coordinator. And he says climate change, along with the pandemic, are making a hard job even worse.
Farm work is the most dangerous job, arguably, in California, always. Their fatality rate is 5 times that of general industry. You've got the climate change making our summers hotter. And then on top of that, you've got COVID-19 and all of the hazards related to that. And then on top of that, you've got the wildfire smoke.
These disasters aren't just happening all at once. They feed into each other. Take COVID-19. Farm workers are particularly at risk here. They're essential workers who often live in crowded housing. Sometimes they commute to work in jam-packed buses or vans. Now that fire season started, advocates like Zeke Guzman expect infections to go up. A lot of farm workers evacuated to friends and family's homes rather than the official evacuation centers, which makes conditions even more crowded. And studies suggest wildfire smoke could make people more vulnerable to COVID-19. Cal OSHA's David Horneig says we have laws that should help keep workers safe through all this.
Obviously, we have our new regulation that started last year to protect workers from wildfire smoke.
Employers have to offer workers N95 masks when the air quality gets bad enough. The state also regulates how long you can work outdoors in extreme heat without water or breaks. And employers need to have a plan in place to protect workers from COVID-19. But labor advocates say they're already hearing stories about vineyards that aren't following these rules.
The accounts we're hearing are very scattered because everyone is either working around the clock or they're concerned with evacuation. And
Omar Paz is the leader of North Bay Jobs with Justice, a Sonoma County nonprofit. He says in the chaos after the LNU Lightning Complex fire started, a former farm worker he knows got in touch with him. The worker said he had family members who were still picking grapes at two vineyards nearby. They were being pressured to bring in the harvest fast.
Masks weren't being provided. The ones that were surgical, not N95s.
Which means farm workers weren't protected from wildfire smoke. In a recent interview, Sonoma County's agricultural commissioner, Andrew Smith, said he hadn't directly heard about these allegations. But workers and labor organizations have made similar claims throughout California's farm country. The United Farm Workers Foundation says 84% of the workers they polled recently had not been given N95 masks by their employers. And Cal OSHA has received several complaints about hazardous wildfire conditions on farms in the past few weeks. Employees and employers are incentivized to work through these conditions. For the people who own these farms, this is the beginning of harvest season. California's agricultural sector is a $40 to $50 billion industry, and wildfire smoke can damage crops like wine grapes if they're not picked quickly. For farm workers, well, this is seasonal work, and in California, they make an average of $18,000 a year. Vineyard workers are paid piece rate. Zeke Guzman says they make between $125 and $150 for every ton of grapes they pick. So the more you pick, the more money you make. And Omar says this dovetails with another disaster farm workers are up against this year: the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic.
People had cashed out their life savings. Their money under their mattresses was gone.
When the pandemic started, it shut down the entire food service industry. No more restaurants or school cafeterias. California's growers lost billions of dollars. And that trickled down to farm workers, who started losing work too. Now, on top of that, more people are competing for the farm jobs that are available. Omar says people who lost service industry jobs are heading out to the fields for the first time.
We have people working in back-of-the-house restaurants and waitressing, things like that, who are for the first time entering the fields. And, you know, they're clunking along, they're learning on the fly, and we have people who are willing to take pay cuts without concern for safety issues and any sort of income they can get.
Local officials, nonprofits, and business leaders are trying to make this situation better. They've distributed tens of thousands of N95 masks to farm workers in the past few weeks. A coalition of community organizations in Sonoma helped farm workers evacuate and get the resources they need. In the meantime, advocates like Omar Paz and Zeke Guzman are connecting with farm workers and documenting their accounts of labor violations. Zeke's also looking ahead to the next crisis. The wildfires mean workers might lose their jobs or homes, he says. That means they'll lose even more money. As we drive back to Healdsburg from the fields, Zeke lets out a sigh.
I really feel sorry for young people nowadays. Big
time. He's been an activist since he was a teenager, and he's 68 now. This is his third major wildfire in 4 years. His house almost burned down this time. Climate change is getting worse, and he says conditions in the fields aren't getting any better.
Do you think it'll turn around?
Never. Never.
You said that so quickly.
We pull into a McDonald's parking lot. We're done for the night. Zeke says he's been up since 5:30.
Farm workers can't afford food that they pick for the rest of us.
If that basic inequity isn't addressed, he says, workers will keep risking their health in the fields. And there will always be employers who are willing to take advantage of that. This story was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit news organization. A version of it was aired on KALW's Cross Currents. So climate change is making systemic inequality even worse, hitting low-income communities and communities of color harder than everyone else. And in some cases, we know these communities will become unlivable, submerged by sea level rise or burned to the ground. What happens when millions of people are forced from their homes by extreme weather? Where do they go? Steve Trent helps us answer some of these questions. He's the co-founder and executive director of the Environmental Justice Foundation in London. Last week, he moderated a conversation about climate refugees at the Global Philanthropy Forum, a conference World Affairs hosts every year. This is an excerpt of his exchange over Zoom with Maxine Burkett, a law professor and expert in climate policy who's the executive director of the Institute for Climate and Peace.
Climate change is a threat multiplier, and it will act in this way across all sectors, all societies, in all geographies. And how we approach this central issue of environmental justice will either prevent or cause further war and conflict, lead to greater equality or inequality between and within nations. It will determine our future, not just as communities or nation states, but as a species. For many years, I've watched as much of the wealthy developed world has somehow viewed climate change as over there and in the future. Perhaps finally that is changing as societies across the world, rich and poor, are increasingly first-hand witnesses to the impacts of global heating. Since 2008, we have seen an average of around 21.2 million people forced from their homes every year by extreme weather. It's 58,000 each day, 41 for each minute. And this does not account for those forced out by slow onset weather events. Now we have some studies that say by 2060, an estimated 1.4 billion people could be forced to leave their homes. To date, there are few cases where climate is the sole factor in migration. But as I have already said, climate change is a threat multiplier. This means that the impacts of climate change are overwhelmingly experienced, first and worst, where exposure to threats coincides with populations dependent on the natural environment for their livelihood. And this is why 95% of displacement has taken place in the developing world, along with 99% of all weather-related deaths. Yet, and we must remember, the world's 50 least developed countries have together contributed less than 1% of global anthropogenic carbon emissions and have benefited the least from our addiction to carbon. Those displaced by the climate crisis are falling through the cracks in our international legal system. International legal frameworks governing migration and refugee rights do not have legal categories which reflect the new reality of climate-induced forced migration. It is true that they are not refugees in the most widely recognized sense of the word, since they are not fleeing persecution, war, or violence, but they are fleeing the destruction of their homes and livelihoods through no fault of their own. What do you believe needs to be done regarding the issue of forced migration, environmentally forced migration, climate refugees, call it what you will? And then if I can add a second question to that, what do you believe can be done recognizing the imperfect world that we live in? Maxine?
Gosh, Steve, thank you so much. First, it's a pleasure to be here. I think the question itself suggests some of the dire need here, which is, what are we calling this? What is the phenomenon? And how do we sort of capture it in a way that it is both true to the complexity, but doesn't suggest a level of overwhelm, right? That we're sort of immobilized in our thinking about this. The way I like to think about climate-induced migration or climate migration, which is generally what I call it, is that it is a function of the place where you are from, where you have deep cultural ties, often where your ancestors are buried, where your family networks have developed over, in many cases, generations, centuries, is no longer able to support your livelihoods. And in so much of what we're doing right now in terms of climate migration is thinking about the triggers, thinking about the places where people will be coming from, how they will move, and their status in transit. And a lot of what we need to also be thinking about is how people can stay in those places that they care so deeply about. I do think you're right in noting that in the future, we are going to be talking about a lot of cross-border migration. At the moment, this is a profoundly local kind of phenomenon for the most part. And I think we need to better understand some of the cultural and sort of psychosocial factors that come in to decision-making around whether or not to stay or to go. And also to recognize that sometimes the migration itself, the ability to move, it is, if it's not the result of a kind of acute incident like a major storm or flood, that the ability to go is really very much determined by your capacity to get a ticket out, right? And so in some ways, when you're seeing projections, the worst of the worst, the situations that are the most dire, the places and individuals who have the fewest resources to actually make that move are trapped in place. And that decision to stay in place should be a decision, right? It shouldn't be a function of circumstances in which you actually see projections in which the countries that are seen to be in the hot spot, there's actually reduced migration because the capacity to leave is not available to them. The other thing I'll say, there are a number of things we could touch on, but the other thing I'll say before sort of pausing is to just describe that when we talk about the receiving communities, the places that people are going, those communities also need to be kept in mind and supported. And that's important because we want to encourage a spirit of welcome, not one of fear. And we want to acknowledge the fact that changes to any environment, whether it's because of new residents, because of environmental stressors that will not spare any community, need to be kept in mind as we're planning. How are we supporting the host or receiving communities? In addition to obviously a big part of the conversation we're having now, which is what are the rights for those who are moving while they're in transit and certainly when they relocate and resettle?
In the context of these estimates, 1.2 billion, 1.4 billion, 1.6 billion, take your pick. We are talking vast numbers. And I think it is true to say, whilst I completely recognize what you say, Maxine, about receiving communities and those communities that are affected, where they want to stay, there will be this huge transboundary migration. What can the international community do to address this? Rather than just allow a wave of human suffering to come and then be reactive to it, is there anything we can do in a proactive measure that can help this situation?
Yeah, great question. Just first on the numbers, right? The numbers are dizzying, and you hear, as you mentioned, something between 1.2 or 1.4 billion people by 2050, 2060, to pick your year. And I think what the numbers do is that they capture the gravity and magnitude of the issue. They beg for notice and they beg for a better understanding about how people make that decision at a level that is meaningful for our engagement. I do worry that we do two things when we use the large numbers. One is that the antennae of the security infrastructure does go up. And we think more about protection, especially in the global north, than about the enabling of sound migration supported in primarily the global south. And I mention this because the fact that it's mostly internal displacement right now means that there's a different kind of way of engagement that we need to consider. And it's not necessarily through international instruments, although that will be important. It's recognizing that I think the failures in the current instruments, I actually, you know, tend to be more of a, instead of building new infrastructure, what about the current infrastructure is failing? And thinking about it creatively in spite of the infrastructure that we have currently, it is really difficult to know what 2060 is going to look like, to be perfectly honest. What we're doing here is a risk assessment. What is absolutely true is that this is a one-sided risk. It's a question of how bad, not a question of if, right? And so if this is the risk assessment, we can at least say we know that it's going to be a big problem, but we also know that 2060 is completely unknown at this point because there are factors that we have not even taken into account that we see playing out right now in 2020.
You've been listening to World Affairs. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider supporting the program you value by making a donation at worldaffairs.org. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from First Republic and Chevron. This episode was produced by Teresa Katsourilis, Jared Sport, and Joanne Jennings. Temba Daniels and Tatum Sanderbeck provided research assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Philip Young. Thank you for listening.